My name is Dick Hilden, and the title of this session is Voices Within Nicaragua. We had a similar session yesterday entitled Voices Within Mexico, and I mentioned at that time, and as is the case today, I would like to be somewhat of a messenger for the people of Nicaragua, people that we had a chance to talk to in a study trip that my wife and I and daughter took last year. I want to be a voice, essentially their voice. I also will describe some of the situation in Nicaragua today and just a little bit of the history of it so that you have sort of a broad brush background of what the situation is there and how it has developed. But essentially I want to just convey to you some of the things that were said to us in that place. Just a brief word before I get started with regard to what to the nature of the next two sessions that I will be doing. Tomorrow at 4 o'clock, I'll be doing a session on Mexico and Nicaragua, case studies of oppression, where we will look in some more detail than we do today, at any rate, at the oppressive conditions that have taken place in Nicaragua and Mexico over the years and in some cases exist today. We'll look at that in more detail. Today I just intend to talk mostly about the situation as it is in Nicaragua. Then on Saturday evening at 7 o'clock we will have a session on faith responses to what is happening in Central America. So if you're here and you would opt to be at those, I wanted to bring those to your attention. I also want to describe for you just very briefly my background so that you know from whence I come and where I come on this particular issue. I am an electrical engineer professionally, but have for many years, or several years, been in corporate management. Just recently, I started an small engineering company in Minneapolis. So essentially, my business is engineering. I also avocationally serve as the chairperson for the Center for Global Service and Education, which is affiliated with Augsburg College. The role of the center is to raise awarenesses of persons with regard to global issues, particularly justice issues and poverty issues, and also particularly as they are taking place in third world countries, and even more specifically Central and all of Latin America. I do have several copies of a newsletter of the center. You may wish to look at one of these or take it with you. The reason I raise this is that to let you know that there are sources for information relative to the third world country situation in primarily Latin America, and this is one of them. The center does put out materials that are helpful in gaining understandings of what is taking place there. And also the center sponsors seminar trips to those countries, and if you were interested in those, I also have brought some brochures which describe those. So I'll leave these here if you wish to take a look at those. I also have a list if you wish to be on a mailing list for that type of resource information. You might want to jot your name and address on it, on that list, and I would see that you do get onto the mailing list. I have some resource materials that you might be interested in. A book I would recommend to you, if you're interested in the struggle for human rights in Latin America, is a book by Penny Lernau called Cry of the People. It's a superb book describing the background and history of the crisis in Latin America, and it places particular emphasis on the role of the Catholic Church in Latin America, which clearly has been very, very significant in the struggles that have taken place in that place. Specifically, with regard to Nicaragua, I recommend to you this book, Now We Can Speak, by Francis Moore Lappay and Joseph Collins. It's a book which discusses interviews with people within the Nicaraguan situation today, and I think speaks very clearly and very pointedly to some of the issues existing there. It's an excellent book, and I recommend it to you. Another person on the staff here, Pat Hayden, has pointed out to me today that she has received a number of copies of Barakata, which is the official newspaper of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, and I would invite you to look at these. These are the English versions of those, and I think it will give you a picture at least of what that press is saying in that country. So, enough now for the references. Just a brief statement about the format of this session. I would like to speak for perhaps 20 to 30 minutes, and then, and during that time, if you have questions where I can help with clarification of something I've said, or if you have a comment, I invite it. Then at the end of that time, I would like to open the session up to discussion, questions, comments, whatever. And a request of you, first of all, that you ask questions if you have them. We're finding at the center, and this has been my experience, my personal experience, is that I'm being inundated with information relative to Nicaragua and other Central American countries. And some of the information is in conflict. And I hear over and over the statement, I don't know what to believe about Central America. And so I would make a request, and that is that you ask questions about it, of me and any other persons that may have information relating to it, and that you seek out materials. The second question, or the second request, is that you stay open-minded and critically analyze the information that you see and read. I think that the United States is probably one of the few places on this planet where we can critically analyze. And I think it's a gift and a privilege that we have, but also I see it as considerable responsibility. So those requests. Just a little bit of historical background relative to Nicaragua. I'm going to go into more detail on this in tomorrow's session, but I'd like to make a relatively quick pass through it just to give you a setting for what is being said here. At the turn of the century, Nicaragua was considered a strong canal candidate by the United States, and we had high interests in it for that purpose. That was essentially the time at which the United States became quite interested in that country. Prior to that, for the 300 previous years of that country, in fact 400, Nicaragua had either been a Spanish colony or in independence it served as a somewhat of a in a mercantile sort of an economy with Europe during the period from 1820, say, to 1900. But what I'd like to say is that about the turn of the century, this century, the United States became quite interested in Nicaragua. In 1911, U.S. banks began to lend money to the country under agreements that gave them control over its finances until the debts were paid. So we had interests as a potential canal location, and we also had financial investments in that country. So our interests developed at that point. And in 1912, the United States, at the request of our banks and President Diaz of Nicaragua, requested that the United States send Marines to Nicaragua to occupy it, or at least to maintain control of those investments. The United States Marines were there from 1912 to 1933, and this U.S. occupation was bitterly resented by the Nicaraguans, by many of them. Rebels led by Augusto Cesar Sandino made many raids on the U.S. Marines from mountain hideouts and were to a great extent responsible for ousting the Marines from Nicaragua. Sandino, a name that rings a bell, I'm sure. During its occupation, the United States trained a very powerful National Guard, and at the time that the United States Marines were taken out of Nicaragua in 1933, Anastasio Somoza was placed at the head of the National Guard of that country. The United States had trained and armed that National Guard and had prepared it to carry on the control that the Marines had done in their stay there. In 1934, after the Marines had left, Somoza invited Sandino to a peace dinner and had him assassinated at it. During the period from 1934 to 1979, the Somoza government was strongly supported by the United States. During this time, it was the Somoza family dominated the country until the year 1979, and specifically July 19th, 1979, when the Sandinista Liberation Front overthrew the Somozan dynasty. During the 45-year period from 34 to 79, the Somoza family ruled Nicaragua either as president or as the real power behind the government and the presidency. The Somozan rule of Nicaragua is a story of terror, story of hunger, brutality, and economic injustice. I think the number is that during that period some 30,000 Nicaraguans died, not in battle, they were non-combatants during that rule of that dynasty. During this period, from 34 to 79, many within the population, particularly the young, were tortured and murdered. Today it is said by persons within Nicaragua, and we heard this a number of times there, that in the 70s, in the mid-70s, it was almost against the law to be young. The experience, because most of the revolution in that country was carried out by the young persons. There's many, many stories of youth who were simply picked up off the street and disappeared. Many stories of torture and many stories of simple disappearance and murder. The majority of the Nicaraguan people at that time had no access to basic health care, services, or education. An earthquake in 1972, you may recall, devastated Managua. More than 10,000 people died and more than 100,000 were left homeless. Millions of dollars of aid were sent to that country. You may recall it. In fact, you may have participated in sending dollars to Nicaragua. Millions of dollars of aid were sent to that country. It did not reach the people. It ended up in Somoza's coffers. There are stories told of aid that was sent to that country in that time after the earthquake, wherein Somoza's National Guard sold the things that were sent there to the peasants. Millions of dollars were borrowed by Somoza for reconstruction of the city, and I'm going to show you some slides of the city, and you're going to see that there hasn't been much reconstruction. Millions of dollars were borrowed by Somoza. They were put in his coffers also, and the reconstruction simply didn't take place. I'm going to show you slides of downtown Managua that looks like you're looking in the desert of Arizona. Is that bleak? That money has ended up in probably Miami banks, Swiss banks, and elsewhere. During this period, the Somoza family amassed great wealth. At the time, incidentally, in 1934, Somoza had essentially no money. During this period, the Somoza family accrued 30% of Nicaragua's arable land, and that was the good land, generally. It acquired 40% of Nicaragua's industry. Can you imagine that? 40% of the industry, including the 26 largest companies in that country, and hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. The Sandinista Front for National Liberation formed in the early 60s, and which was named after Sandino, the man in the 30s resisted the American Marines, successfully led the overthrow of the Somozan government in July of 79. That is, the Sandinista Liberation Front was successful, and in July of 1979 triumphed, overthrowing the Somozan government. There was hardly a sector in that country that didn't want Somoza overthrown. I mean, the private sector, the church, the rebels, and you can go down the line, almost every sector in that country, with the exception of those that were very close to Somoza, joined in that revolution and were successful in the overthrow. It's estimated that 50,000 Nicaraguan lives were lost in that revolution. When we talked to people, they did not want to have a violent revolution. They wanted desperately not to, and they went through a considerable amount of struggle coming to the point where they realized that a violent revolution was probably necessary in order to overthrow
what was such a brutal dynasty of the Somozas. Nicaragua, at the time of the triumph, that is in July 19th of 79, was a country devastated by war. In the last few years of the revolution, Somoza realized that he was going to was in desperate straits and probably going to be overthrown, bombed his own country. Neighborhoods in Managua were bombed by the Air Force of Nicaragua. At the time of the successful revolution, it was a country impoverished. People were very poor. It was a country with $1.6 billion debt. Oh, I guess I haven't mentioned how large Nicaragua is. It's about the size of Iowa and has about 2.5 million people. So when we say 50,000 people were lost, that's just an incredibly large portion of that population that died for that freedom. And $1.6 billion foreign debt is an exceedingly large foreign debt. That's the debt that Somoza left to that country. The revolutionary government honored that debt, restructured it, and has been faithful in servicing that debt, and fully intends to do so. At the time of the revolution, there was about $3 million in the treasury, which is enough for about 2 days. So I think you get a picture of a situation where there is a people somewhat impoverished, huge debt, finding it now necessary to build that society from the ground up. In Nicaragua today, there is free health care available to most Nicaraguans. Two, the National Literacy Campaign has reduced illiteracy from 50% to about 12% since the revolution. At the time of the revolution, illiteracy was the case for 50% of the population. It has been reduced to 12%. Immediately after the revolution, the government said, asked persons within the country who had education and were able to read and write if they would volunteer to go into the cities and the rural areas to teach people how to read and write. 100,000 people in that country responded to that and volunteered to do it. And in spite of the fact that many other governments said you're not going to be able to improve your literacy situation very fast, the Nicaraguans, who are very, very young and very inexperienced, tried that and were exceedingly successful at it. Although, obviously, it's only been 4 years and it's going to take a long time for that country to develop an in-depth literacy. Something like 40% of the people in Nicaragua now are involved in education. So they continue very strongly on their emphasis of education. Next point, in Nicaragua today, a human rights commission has been organized to monitor internal human rights violations. That is, human rights violations in the prisons and other places where we normally would consider human rights violations to occur. There is a Mary Noel Nunn, an American by the name of Mary Hartman, who is the director of that. We visited with her in Nicaragua. She said, we are able to go into any prison in this country. We're able to talk to any prisoner by ourselves in isolation. She said, we have determined some violation of human rights in the prisons, and where that has happened, remedial action has taken place, and in some cases, the persons that were responsible for the human rights violations were dismissed from their jobs. Nicaragua is the only Latin American country that has responded with this kind of a human rights commission, as has been requested by the United Nations, rather. So it appears that they're paying good attention to that. There has been merciful treatment by the government of former Somoza National Guardsmen. And remember now, these are people that tortured and killed people. At the time of the revolution, when it was successful, immediately capital punishment was eliminated. The new revolutionary government had captive at that point 8,000 Somoza National Guardsmen. It released shortly thereafter 4,000 of them. There were not prisons enough in Nicaragua, as you might guess. In fact, at the time of the revolution, there were only sufficient rooms for 600 people in Nicaraguan prisons, which which is a rather small amount, and there were only 200 people in those prisons. Now, you might ask why such a small number, and I think when you consider what happened in that country, it becomes fairly clear. The country under Somoza generally didn't keep prisoners very long. They were literally tortured and murdered. And there are the techniques, I won't go into them now, they're brutal, for the methods of torture that were used and the methods of murder. Many grassroots organizations are being formed today, including labor unions, farm workers associations, women's group, and others. The other night we talked about the plight of women in Latin America at the Mexico session that we had. And someone asked me whether it was the situation in all of Latin America that women are not very liberated, or their situation is not very one of being liberated. And I responded, I thought that that was the situation throughout Latin America. I wish I had thought soon enough to respond that it is not the case in Nicaragua. There is great emphasis on women's rights and the rights of the handicapped and the disadvantaged in that country. There are women's groups that are encouraged and are forming, and that needs to be said. Land reformation is being implemented. The law of agrarian land reform was announced in July of 81. The law guarantees individual property rights, but only as long as the owner uses the land productively. The land reformation program puts great emphasis on the productive use of the land. And if very large landowners do in fact have land that is sitting idle, it will be redistributed under the land reformation program. So the key with regard to their land reformation program is productivity. I guess I'd have to say that Nicaragua does not have a very tough job with land reformation. At the time of the revolution, when it took place, I should say the triumph in July of 79, the government essentially took all the land that Somoza had, and through the land reformation program has worked to redistribute that. So it hasn't been a significant problem for that country, that is, having resources. At the time of the revolutionary triumph, it was there was a good deal of land available. A couple more points relative to Nicaragua today. The Nicaraguan government is in favor of an internal structure that is balanced between the private sector and the public sector. It does not go to either extreme. It is looking for a balanced economy or a balanced economic structure. Another point, trade and loan sources to Nicaragua today are heavily oriented toward the West and third world countries. And the reason I say this, it is not heavily oriented toward the socialist countries. I have figures on that, and if I have time at the end, I would give those to you. But okay, there are problems in Nicaragua, and things that we need to be concerned about and that the Nicaraguans need to be and are concerned about. The country has declared itself to be on a war footing since February of 1982, and since that time, there has been censorship of the press. This paper, as I mentioned to you, is the official publication of the Sandinista government. La Prensa is the anti-government newspaper, and there's one other, and these newspapers are censored, and particularly La Prensa is. Secondly, there is resistance to the revolutionary government from representatives of the private business sector. There's no question about the fact that the government, in fact, is implementing policies that are less attractive to the private sector, particularly the large businesses. There is a redistribution of the resources in that country since the revolutionary triumph to the people of the country. And so there is resistance to that. We talked to a man who is essentially the head of the, in effect, the Chamber of Commerce of that country. And he indicated to us some of the complaints that they had on that basis. Another point about Nicaragua today. There is opposition to the revolutionary government on the part of the Roman Catholic hierarchy in Nicaragua. Another point. There seems to be a strong feeling on the part of the Nicaraguan people in general of resentment and fear of the covert actions of the United States and the overt actions. The people are fearful of an attack by the United States-supported Somocistas that are just along the Honduran border. The people are fearful of the aircraft carriers that we have poised with their task forces. I'm not sure there's one on either side of the country, on the Pacific side as well as the Atlantic side, but I think we have placed those major task forces there, and I think they're both aircraft carriers. And also there is work or United States supported peoples in Costa Rica who the United States is trying to incite to work toward the overthrow of that country. The people are fearful of that and they resent it. They feel they are being highly intimidated by the United States with these military forces there. I'm going to talk about that in some detail tomorrow. So I'll just move on at this point in time. The Nicaraguan government does have Marxists within it and does seem to be moving toward the Eastern Bloc, although it wishes to be unaligned. One of its stated positions is that it does not want to be aligned with Russia. It doesn't want to be aligned with the United States either. It doesn't want to be aligned. But it is in desperate straits economically, and it needs assistance and is looking to whoever will provide it. A comment about its desire to trade with the United States. Nicaragua's capital equipment base is United States oriented. It simply has every reason in the world to want to continue trade with the United States and does want to do it. It cannot make a rapid change or even it would be just an extended and very difficult change to become more east-oriented with regard to its equipment base. Its entire economy is based on that equipment base, which is more oriented toward the United States products. The Nicaraguan government does want good relations with the United States. Okay, I would like to get on to the slides very quickly. Would you snap that on for me, please? Well, let me just give you a quick review of Nicaragua. It's in Central America, and I'm sorry it isn't oriented with regard to the other countries. To the north of it is Honduras, to the south is Costa Rica. On its western border is the Pacific Ocean, on its eastern is the Caribbean or the Atlantic Ocean. Again, it's about the size of Iowa, as I mentioned, and has about 2.5 million people in it. This is the center of Managua. If you had seen this before the earthquake, you would have seen many buildings there. This is what it looks like now. You recall I mentioned that the Nicaraguan government borrowed much money for reconstruction of the center of the city. It didn't happen. We sent millions in aid for that reconstruction. It didn't happen. And here, this is what you see. Can you imagine walking into Seattle and seeing this? The earthquake was devastating. This cathedral, which is adjacent to the National Palace, essentially the center square of the city, was quite ruined in the earthquake, and Somoza did not restore it. This is the inside of it. So it is essentially unusable. This view is from the top of the Continental Hotel, looking down toward the center of the city. I think that building is the Bank of America building, which did survive the earthquake, but it is just somewhat of a shell at this point. You can see the openness of the downtown. This is the bunker that Somoza lived in. He was so hated in that country that he had a very tightly controlled place that he lived in. The military security there was just incredible. Here you see a poster of Sandino, who is a hero, of course, of that country. He is revered as a national hero. His life did inspire the Sandinista revolutionary movement, as I mentioned. There also also is a memorial to Carlos Fonseca, who was one of the young founders of the Sandinista Liberation Front. He was killed before the triumph. He was killed in 1976 in some battles in the Northern Mountains. This is a man from Tennessee. He is a representative, or a member, I should say, of clergy and laity concerned. He is reading a statement of support from that group. There were a group of visitors from the United States, from Cal, and they read a paper of support for the Nicaraguan government. And here is a member of the government responding to that statement of support. You see soldiers here. There is a military presence in Nicaragua, but it's very unimposing. During our time there, and I think you would experience this as well, there's very little concern about insecurity there. They're very friendly. They do not wish to be imposing, and they aren't. So you don't have a feeling of insecurity. The one bit of insecurity that you probably do have, which we experienced a little bit, is that these are probably 16, 17, and 18-year-olds carrying these weapons. So one worries a little bit on the score that there might be some immaturity there. But that is kind of characteristic of that country. They are young and inexperienced, and that's the way it is. I happened to come across a Boy Scout troop. There were two Boy Scout troops at a church that we visited one Sunday morning, and there were just little boys there, relatively young, and I said, how come there aren't 15, 16, 17-year-old leaders? And they said, because it is necessary for them to be not in the military, but at least in the militia. So they tend not to be involved in Boy Scouts, but are more associated with the militia. This man's name is Roel. I don't remember his last name. He is the head of the penal system. And as I mentioned to you, at the time of the triumph, the capital punishment was eliminated immediately. And there was a great attempt to conduct trials for the Somoza National Guardsmen that were held captive at that time. And 4,000 of them were released. There is still something like 3,000 of them incarcerated. We did visit a state prison and talk to some of them. The government is now assuring them of trial, so that in fact many of them, I believe, will be released in the next year or two, probably. One problem that the revolutionary government had with regard to its rather lenient policy was with these prisoners was that people whose sons and daughters and husbands had been brutally treated by the National Guard's persons wanted the punishment to be more severe. So there was a problem following the triumph where peoples wanted the penalties to be leveled in much greater depth than they were. This is Mary Hartman. She is the woman that I mentioned is the chairperson, the director of the Human Rights Commission. She is an American, a Mary Knoll nun. She also, another interesting point, Mary talked to us about her serving in a barrio where she worked, or where she served. She had a youth group of 90 youth about 10 years ago, just a few years before the revolution took place. 50% of them are alive today, of her group of 90. She was in a barrio where there was a considerable amount of bombing and a lot of battle associated with the revolution. We did visit one of the prisons. This man was an inmate there. He is due to be released in the not too distant future. You may know that the counter-revolutionaries that we, the United States, are supporting in Honduras were former Somoza National Guardsmen, almost exclusively. And we asked this man, if when you're released, are you free to go to Honduras to join the counter-revolutionaries? And he said, yes, we are. But he said, I'm not going to. I choose not to. But we are free to do it. I think that shows some almost naivety on the part of the Nicaraguan government to release these Somoza National Guards persons who might go back. But that's the way they have approached things. They have been lenient. Here is another prisoner who enjoyed singing and did sing for us. This young high school girl is part of the literacy campaign volunteer. She comes to this prison, I'm not sure how often, but probably two or three times a week, to teach the prisoners how to read and write. Now, bear in mind again that these are the former Somoza National Guardsmen who are being taught. We had a chance to review the materials that they're using, and they are quite oriented toward the building of their new society. The materials are quite oriented toward the revolutionary process, which they consider to be going an ongoing thing. That's the way they are structured. But we thought it was very interesting that the government does take has taken such gross or large efforts to develop the literacy program to include these prisoners. There were children from the neighborhood who also were involved in the literacy campaign in the prison. Here are two orphans that live nearby. We went to a meeting on one Friday night where members of the government came to speak to people in this barrio, that is, this neighborhood. This is in a Catholic parish in Nicaragua. It's in the parish that Mary Hartman served. This parish experienced a great deal of conflict in the revolutionary process. There are two persons from the three-person junta that came, and several ministers came to this. They do this every Friday night. They spend 3 hours in various locations throughout the country listening to the people's problems. And the people raise questions such as, our sewage doesn't work, why doesn't it? And the leaders take time to deal with that. We were impressed by this process. 3 hours on a hot Friday night is a considerable time, but certainly one that they consider to be a necessary process of the building up of this of their new life. We visited a textile factory. This particular factory had been blown up during the revolutionary process, but has been reconstructed. There is a parts boycott on the part of the United States. We are boycotting parts to Nicaragua and materials. So many of these the machines in this textile factory are not working as a result of it. Again, I'll go into that in more detail tomorrow. We talked to this woman who is a former junior high teacher in Los Angeles. She is a volunteer in Nicaragua. She came back to Minneapolis about a month ago, or maybe 2 months ago, and spoke and said that with regard to the parts boycott problem, they have IBM typewriters in their institute. It's the Historical Institute of Latin America, I believe is the title of the institute. They cannot get parts for their IBM typewriters. They simply can't get them. They've tried many, many avenues, but the boycott of those parts by the United States is such that their typewriters simply are inoperative. And she said that is the case over and over with regard to the spare parts problem that exists in that country. And I think it shows one thing, and that is the very high dependence upon the trade with the United States. I mentioned before that their equipment base is so strongly oriented toward that in America. That's a case where that is the case. This is Pat Edmiston. She's a nurse. She lives in a barrio or a neighborhood that has 70,000 people in it. Before the revolution, there was one clinic, there was one doctor, and one nurse. They worked 3 to 4 hour days, weekdays. Since the revolutionary process, there are 3 clinics, 10 doctors, and 70 medical personnel total in this barrio of 70,000. So I think there's a high contrast between the health and medical care available before and after the revolution. This is Justinian. He was a Catholic priest from Sheboygan, Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. He has been in Nicaragua for 25 years and is serving now in an organization there that deals with farm education. I can't remember. Ah, here it is. He works at the Center for the Promotion of Agricultural Education. He said that 95% of the people supporting the revolution are baptized Christians. And we hear in this country that Nicaragua has lost some of its Christian influence. He told us that the Association of Farm Workers, known as a militant organization and at the forefront of the government, is understood to be 99% Christian. There is an extremely heavy Christian influence in Nicaragua today. We visited a state farm. We talked to these people who work on the state farm. Here you can see some of the group that visited with us. The Nicaraguans warmly received us, incidentally. I was going to say before, I appreciated your being here on such a beautiful, beautiful day. You couldn't be out hiking. We visited a Catholic parish one morning and worshiped with them one Sunday morning. And the priest wanted to put the people at rest a little bit. And he said, there are 20 North Americans here. We went with a group of 20. And he said, but be assured that they have an interest in what we are doing and interest in us here. If they hadn't been, they would be in Acapulco. We've stopped in Acapulco on the way down. And I similarly applaud you for being here on such a beautiful day today. It does reflect an interest in that place. This is Jose Torres, Jose Miguel Torres. He is a Nicaraguan Baptist pastor serving in Managua. He told us this, that Protestants came to Nicaragua believing that they were not to be political. And I'm going to read this. It is a quote. In 1966, young Protestant evangelicals could not escape the example of the Roman Catholic youth who were involved in the struggle for liberation from the Somozan tyranny. In this way, evangelical youth first learned the role of the Christian in social justice. They went through a considerable struggle determining whether they should be involved politically with the revolutionary process, and finally came to the conclusion that they should. He told us that Dietrich Bonhoeffer served as an outstanding model for them. You may have remembered Bonhoeffer's role in resistance of the Third Reich during the war. He served as a considerable model for them, as did Martin Luther King. He also told us that he believes that there is no other country in the world where there is so much study and discussion of theology as in Nicaragua. And that was his opinion, but he says that there's an incredible amount. He said the United States is the strongest threat to the government of Nicaragua. The people of Nicaragua are willing to die to the last person fighting the U.S. or a U.S.-supported invasion from Honduras. I think he was perhaps exaggerating a little bit that maybe not every person would die, but I think he is quite accurate in saying that a large majority of the Nicaraguan people would die as opposed to being overrun militarily by a U.S. or any other supported military action against Nicaragua.
I have a question.
Yes.
We're supporting the Nicaraguan Somozan regime, is that it?
No, we are not supporting the Somozan regime. He left the country in 1979, and in July of 79. He went to Miami and then to Paraguay, where he was assassinated, I think in September of 81. So there does not exist now a Somozan constituency. What does exist, or if there is any, it's quite negligible. What does exist are a group of former National Guardsmen of the Somozan regime who have been trained in the United States covertly by the CIA, as has been revealed to us over the past several months, you may recall. And we are supporting that group. They are located principally in Honduras, just north of the Nicaraguan border.
That's the point I was trying to get. There, we're supporting them in Honduras.
Yes, we're supporting them in Honduras. They are making it.
We're supporting their counterparts in Nicaragua.
No.
The Sandinistas.
No, we are not supporting the Sandinistas. Our foreign policy, the United States foreign policy, is to is to hold that government in check or in fact destabilize the government, the Sandinista government. And we are doing it. One of the mechanisms that we're attempting to do that is through the military support and training of those former Somoza National Guard.
What is the reason for that? What is the reason for that posture?
We will get into that tomorrow. The question is, what is the reason for our posture, the posture of the United States? We'll get into that in more detail tomorrow. Just a word about it, very quick word about it. As you know, our perspective of the situation in Central America tends to be that the crisis is due to an East-West struggle. We are concerned about the fact that in Nicaragua we have a successful revolution where there are where the government in fact is implementing some socialistic reform. We worry that may be associated with communist intervention, and we worry that it might be emanating, say, from the Eastern Bloc. That is sort of the perspective that we hold in this country, at least that perspective which is influencing our foreign policy. But I don't want to get into that too much today, but essentially it is that fear of the East that tends to make our position rather one of being militarily intimidating there.
But certainly our diplomats and other people that are in there could see the same thing you have seen. Why do they take such a diametrically opposed position? Or don't they see it?
I don't think they do. We have Congress people who have traveled to Nicaragua who do see who do have the same perspective as those other Americans who have gone there simply out of interest in finding out what is going on. The Center for Global Service has sponsored several trips there in the past year, some probably two, maybe 250 people. Almost without exception, they come back with that feeling. Similarly, other Americans that travel there for these purposes come back almost without exception with those feelings. It's hard to answer your question. I have a difficult time understanding how our high-level diplomats go there and do not change perspective. There have to be forces involved here that are difficult to understand. Yes?
Well, you mentioned that the Marines occupied Nicaragua. I hadn't heard the word occupied used. Is this in the same sense that a nation would occupy a country after a war has been won?
The Marines occupied the country to the extent that it could control the stability of the country, such that the investments would be protected. I don't know the mechanisms through which they did that, but one would have to understand, I think, that they would have to be fairly deeply ingrained in that country, and I would speculate that might be very similar to a military occupation of a country that had been defeated.
You don't have any figures on how many Marines were there?
I don't. No, I could get those for you. I think I could track that down. Yes.
Well, the United States has been in support of the Somozan government over the years, and this has happened in other countries like Iran and so on. And what is the philosophy of the United States in this regard? Why and what would be the alternative?
We visited with the ambassador, the United States ambassador to Nicaragua in Managua, and asked him a question very similar to that. We said, how could we support the Somozan government over those years when there was so much brutality? And he emphasized that we have changed our position, that we would not support that kind of dictatorial regime at this point, which was a kind of a vague answer. I think the answer to that is that we tend to look for stability in countries like that, even though the stability might be in the form of a dictatorial government of the type that Somoza had.
What else could they do?
What else could...
What would be the alternative?
The alternative is suggested by what is taking place in Nicaragua today. Nicaragua is suggesting that there is a third alternative to a highly dictatorial government of the Somozan type, an alternative to the totalitarian type of governments we see in the communist East countries, and that is a government that is a combination that has a mixed economy, for example, capitalistic together
but
with
the United States couldn't very well set that up.
It couldn't set it up, but it could certainly encourage the Nicaraguan government to proceed on the basis that it is proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
So Nicaragua is suggesting a third alternative to that. The other alternatives are terrible. The obviously the Somozan alternative was just disastrous. 30,000 people dying in a situation like that is a disaster. And some of the other totalitarian governments similarly are disasters. So I think we need to very critically look at Nicaragua and see if in fact what is happening there might represent a very good alternative for those countries.
Yes. We put a blockade against import into Nicaragua. We're trying to drag them right into the other form of government anyway.
That's a good point. In fact, we do drive them toward the east, as we refuse to assist them. They need assistance badly. They will get assistance wherever they can get it because their economic situation is so painful. So in fact, they are moving toward the east now as a result of the fact that the United States is not supporting them. We asked this man, this is Aldo Diaz, who is in the Foreign Ministry of Nicaragua. He described the fact that there are 3,000 Cubans, essentially, in Nicaragua, most of which are in health and educational volunteer work. There are some small number of military advisors, but we didn't see any, and Joel Muggy, who has been to Nicaragua 9 times in the last 3 years, has not seen a Russian or a Cuban, so there can't be many there. But anyway, Cuban or Russian military advisors. Anyway, we asked Aldo Diaz, why are there so many Cubans here? And his response to us was a little bit embarrassing. He asked the question, why aren't there Americans here? They have pleaded with the United States, as well as other countries, to give them assistance. And our response has been quite negative on that. Are there any other questions? Aldo also said to us, he said that almost on a daily basis, Nicaragua seeks high-level discussions with the United States. And we asked him, what can we do? What message would you have us take back to the United States if you had the choice to do that? And he said, do this. Tell your government to talk to us. And he said, and if in fact the United States won't help us, then for God's sake, leave us alone. That was his statement to us. This little boy captured our heart. He was at the prison farm, and we just loved him. I might say that the Nicaraguan people are very warm to Americans, extremely warm. And this little boy kind of symbolizes that. I'm going to turn the slide thing off. Would you do that? Maybe just put it down 2 notches. That's fine. Now the fan will cool down. And simply open this up to other discussion if you have any other questions.
Well, when you tell our government, how do you do that? Right, your congressman?
The question is, how do we let our government know our feelings on this, if we have them? And the answer to that is, we do write our congressman and the president. And I have found that writing to the congressman has had just an incredible effect. The senators from Minnesota, at least Senator Durenberger, has taken a considerable different position, I think, because he has received a lot of mail. And that's what I would say about that point. Other questions? It's Tomorrow I will get into more specifics with regard to what our position has been with regard to Nicaragua, more details of that, and also talk a little bit about some of the oppression that is taking place in Mexico and perhaps a few other places in Central America. So thank you very much for being here today.